You're listening to America's Web Radio and the Infectious Disease Program exclusively on AmericasWebRadio.com. On the line is Sharon Sanders from Flu Trackers, and she's got a very special guest this morning, or this afternoon, I should say. And I'm going to turn the show right over to Sharon. Sharon, good afternoon. I'm doing great, and I can't wait to get started because obviously we heard a little bit of you all getting started with your chat as we were getting a level, and it's all yours, kid.
Great. Well, we're very lucky today to have Dr. David S. Fedson, who has spent many years studying pandemic influenza, and of course his specialty is vaccines. He received his BA in American Studies from Yale University in 1959. He spent the next 2 years teaching English at New Asia College in Hong Kong under the Yale China program. He received his medical degree from Yale University in 1965, spent the next year on a fellowship studying smallpox in London and India, and then trained at the Osler Medical Service at the Johns Hopkins Hospital. He served as a clinical associate at the Laboratory of Clinical Investigation at the National Institutes of Health and chief medical resident at the University of Chicago. He has held faculty appointments at the University of Chicago and the University of Virginia, where he was the Harry T. Peters, Jr. Professor of Medicine and the head of the Division of General Medicine. From 1982 to 1990, Dr. Fedson served on the Task Force on Adult Immunization of the American College of Physicians and edited the second edition of the ACP's Guide for Adult Immunization. From 1984 to 1988, he was a member of the U.S. Public Health Service's Immunization Practices Advisory Committee, and from 1988 to 1990, served as the ACP liaison representative to that committee. From 1992 to 1993, he served as a consultant to the Division of Communicable Diseases at the World Health Organization in Geneva, Switzerland. He was a member of the National Vaccine Advisory Committee from 1990 to 1994 and wrote the report on adult immunization that was submitted to the Assistant Secretary of Health in 1994. In 1995, Dr. Fedson joined the medical department at Adventist Pasteur in Lyon, France, where he continued his studies on the epidemiology and cost-effectiveness of influenza and pneumococcal vaccination. In 2001, he helped establish the Influenza Vaccine Supply International Task Force, which represents major vaccine companies and is concerned with vaccine supply for the next influenza pandemic. Since retiring in November of 1992, he has continued to work full-time on influenza and pneumococcal vaccination. He organized and coordinates the activities of the Microepidemiology Influenza Vaccination Study Group. He has published more than 160 scientific articles and chapters on issues related to adult immunization. In 1999, he received the Research Achievement Award in Adult Immunization in the United States, given jointly by the Centers for Disease Control Prevention and the Healthcare Financing Administration and the National Coalition on Adult Immunization. Welcome, Dr. Fedson.
Well, thank you. I hope you still have a few listeners.
Well, I wanted to get that on the record because it's important to understand your background in immunization, vaccines, and of course your overall general medical background. In addition to the fact that you've worked in places as diverse as India, because mm-hmm. it gives you a real good sense, I think, a background on the more needier populations potentially in the world, not just, you're not just in industrial countries, it's not just your forte. You have a real good understanding of the living conditions and the medical needs around the world, which is something that we really concentrate on, Flu Trackers.
Well, I think you're correct. I do not think that I would be doing today what I am doing had I not been able and been very fortunate to spent 2 years in Hong Kong teaching a long time ago, and then doing research in India for almost a year, and then going back to India many times, and then over decades actually being fortunate enough to travel in many parts of the world. And I literally have been on all of the continents except Antarctica. And it gives one a perspective, I think, on what the world's needs will be when everyone in the world is faced with confronting an influenza pandemic.
Right. Recently you wrote a paper called Meeting the Challenge of Influenza Pandemic Preparedness in Developing Countries. And in that paper, basically, and correct me if I'm wrong, you say that basically, we're not going to be able to meet a vaccine production capacity for the world in any kind of short order to protect the masses, the billions that live on the planet. And you are and have advocated for some time the use of commonly available generics as treatment protocol for pandemic influenza. Can you explain that to us?
Well, that's sort of a God, man, nature, and society in 15 minutes kind of question, so we probably ought to break it up into several pieces. First of all, let's focus on vaccines. I believe in vaccines. I've spent my academic career studying vaccination, not vaccines so much, but vaccination. If vaccines are there, do people use them? Are they worthwhile? Are they cost-effective? Do we have good measures of how they affect the health of populations? And I conducted probably the first large population study that showed influenza vaccination reduces hospitalization and death during the flu season. So I believe in influenza vaccines. I think they're good. They're not perfect, but nothing is. They have contributed enormously to the health of populations in which they've been used. But I think if we look around the world today, we find that most of the vaccines are used in developed countries, that developing countries do not use much, if any, influenza vaccine, and the developing countries constitute 85% of the global population. And so we have to say what's going to happen to those folks when we have a pandemic. Now, the influenza vaccine companies and influenza scientists, with some government support, largely from the United States, have worked very, very hard over the last, I would say, 6 or 7 years, and they've been put on alert since 1997 when the Hong Kong experience with H5N1 first arose. They worked very, very hard to develop vaccines for pandemic influenza, assuming that the most likely candidate for a pandemic will be the H5N1 virus, which is currently causing disease in Southeast Asia, but in other countries, including Egypt and places a little closer to where we are. This work has progressed reasonably well, reasonably rapidly. But when you step back and say, well, okay, if we had a pandemic, say, that started next week or even a year from now, would we be able to produce effective vaccines against an H5N1 virus and deliver them to the populations throughout the world? And the answer to anybody who's got his feet on the ground has got to be no. Now, we can't do that. The vaccine production capacity that exists in the companies that produce vaccines is largely concentrated in 9 countries, the United States, Canada, 5 countries in Western Europe, Australia, and Japan. There are efforts that are being made to expand production capacity in other countries, including China, and perhaps even India, but those countries will take many, many years before they build their industrial capacity, and even so, country like China has got 1.3 billion people to provide vaccines for, and it's going to take even China a long time to achieve that. So we have most of the world's population that will just not be able to obtain supplies of vaccines. Furthermore, even if we use some of the best science that tells us how to formulate a vaccine so that we use the conventional injected killed virus vaccine, and we add to it what's called an adjuvant, which improves the immunogenicity, the ability of the vaccine to stimulate protective antibodies. This allows you to reduce the amount of vaccine material called the antigen in each dose, so you can actually stretch the supply of antigen quite a bit. Under those circumstances, if we take a look at, say, the first 6 to 9 months of a pandemic period, the number of doses that the vaccine companies in these 9 countries can produce will be about as much as large a number as the number of people in those 9 countries. And we know, I think, because we understand human nature, that the presidents and the prime ministers and the chancellors who rule these countries will say, we're not going to let any of our vaccine out to other countries until we protect our own people. And that's justified, because that's why these leaders were elected to office. So if in the first 6 to 9 months of the pandemic period, the vaccine that is produced is going to stay holed up in the countries that are producing it, what's going to happen with the other countries? And this is not just developing countries. This is countries like Spain, which doesn't have a vaccine company. It's countries like Sweden, which doesn't have a vaccine company. So there are going to be a lot of have-not countries in the world that will simply not be able to obtain vaccines. Now, let's assume for the moment that, say, we could produce 3 or 4 times as many doses of vaccine and produce it more quickly so that we could get a lot of vaccine, billions of doses of vaccine, out to the world in a matter of 3 or 4 or 5 months. How are we going to deliver that? I mean, just we can produce it, but once it's produced, what's going to be the supply chain to get it to all of these countries? How is it going to be regulated? What are the registration authorities in the countries going to do to allow these vaccines to come in? Who's going to pay for this? Because it's going to be a huge amount of vaccine coming in over a very short period of time. And once it reaches the country, what's the delivery system for getting it to people? Do we have enough syringes and needles to use for injections? And clearly, today, we don't. There are a huge number of logistical issues that are a function of how well organized and how well managed a vaccination program will be. So having the biological product, the vaccine, but without understanding anything and making no preparations for the management and logistics of getting it into people means that that it's going to be difficult, if not impossible, to vaccinate more than several hundred million people. Almost all of them in developed countries.
Correct.
Does that make you happy?
Well, no, it doesn't make me happy because, you know, whatever diseases are in other parts of the world are really basically with the way we're in such a small world now with our transportation systems, et cetera, that any disease that's in Africa is really in the United States also. It's not, you know, we're not isolated. These oceans don't protect the different and various countries from any other thing happening someplace else. It will come to you anyway. So if we're not protecting Africa and if we're not protecting, you know, parts of India and other places, we're also not protecting ourselves in the United States, particularly where I live.
Yeah.
Or Western Europe or any other place. So we really are each other's all man's keeper now. It really is true, I think.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and we've seen evidence in the sort of pre-pandemic period and with our concern for the potential impact, global impact of a pandemic. We've seen evidence of what the consequences are of this for international political harmony and really security in the standoff that currently exists between the World Health Organization and the government of Indonesia, particularly the health minister of Indonesia. Now, in January of 2007, she announced that her country, Indonesia, would no longer share with the World Health Organization laboratory surveillance system the viruses that they isolate from the H5N1-infected patients in Indonesia. And her argument was very straightforward. She said, look, we send these viruses to WHO. WHO laboratories then send them free of charge to vaccine companies who produce H5N1 vaccines and then want to sell them to us at a price that we can't afford. You know, and WHO says, well, we're working on this and we'll try to work out a better arrangement so you get supplies of vaccine. But the Indonesian health minister was saying, in effect, look, we send you stuff, the viruses, and you send us words, and that's not good enough. We want something in return. We want guarantees. We want to control the intellectual property rights for the vaccine, for the viruses that we send out, and we want some sort of guaranteed mechanism that will have access to supplies of vaccines at an affordable price. Now, this all came down in early 2007. Very large international meetings with representatives from over 100 countries attending these meetings to try to work through this impasse between Indonesia and WHO and its international surveillance system, and there's no resolution, and there will never be any resolution to this question because the industrial capacity to produce and the organizational and logistical capacity to deliver pandemic vaccines to a country like Indonesia that has 13,000 islands simply doesn't exist, and we've got to realize that we can't get there from here. We simply will not be able to manage this within the time frame that we will have to deal with.
Right. I think Indonesia is now beginning work on their own vaccine plan.
Well, yes, and the Vietnamese are working on developing a vaccine. Other countries are doing it. Brazil will become self-sufficient in producing its own seasonal influenza vaccine within a year or two. I mean, these are all very positive developments. But we have to keep in mind that whenever a developing country develops a vaccine facility for pandemic vaccination, it has to use that facility to produce seasonal influenza vaccines. And if it doesn't have an awareness of influenza as a seasonal disease that is important to prevent, and it doesn't have programs to use seasonal influenza vaccines, then it's not going to be it's not going to have any reason to produce a large number of doses of seasonal influenza vaccine, and it can't afford to keep a vaccine production facility sort of sitting on the shelf waiting for the pandemic to arrive. I mean, no company would ever do that, and it will never be done anywhere in the world. You have to, if you have an industrial facility, you have to be using it for other reasons, and it has to be capable of being switched over to pandemic vaccine production literally in a matter of a few days.
Yes, so as a alternative, you've been proposing the use of generic, commonly available generic drugs to mitigate a pandemic, yeah. And you want to explain what you're
trying to do. Well, yeah, okay, before we get there, let's spend a little time on some of the antivirals that are being produced and in a few countries stockpiled.
Mm-hmm.
The most important of those is an anti-neuraminidase inhibitor that many people will recognize as Tamiflu.
Mm-hmm.
Tamiflu is produced by Roche Pharmaceuticals. They're based in Switzerland. The drug itself is produced in several countries. This drug is still under patent protection, and therefore Roche sells it at a fairly high price for preventing seasonal influenza. And by and large, it's a very good drug that, if given within the first 2 days of clinical illness, shortens the duration of illness, and you get better quicker. If personal experience means anything, my son had influenza this past winter, and I started him on Tamiflu within 12 hours of the onset of his symptoms, and he felt lousy for a couple of days, but 5 days after his influenza started, he was out skiing, and he skied the whole day, and he didn't get tired. So it's a good drug, but it's expensive, and governments have stockpiled it in anticipation of the pandemic, but they've stockpiled it only to cover 5, 10, 15, 20%, in some countries, a few, one or two, as many as 50% of their populations, but at great cost. Now, they get some markdown, I'm sure, on the price that they have to pay, but if an individual were to go out and buy Tamiflu and take it for 5 days, it would cost close to $90 in the United States. And that's a $90 treatment for 5 days for an individual is not the sort of treatment that can be afforded by people in developing countries. The other hooker here, and it is huge, is that one of the seasonal viruses, the H1N1 virus, has now developed almost universal resistance to this. And because resistance to the antiviral by the virus itself can develop and spread throughout the world within a matter of a year, this makes government officials who are considering buying Tamiflu for their own national stockpiles wonder whether or not they're buying a drug that the pandemic virus will quickly develop resistance to, and it will mean that their stockpiles are useless. So they have another reason to do nothing. And currently today, the government stockpiles of Tamiflu worldwide amount to probably less than 250 million treatment courses. That means 250 million people could be treated. Three-quarters of those doses that are stockpiled in the nine countries that produce vaccines, and the have-not countries that don't produce vaccines have stockpiles that would allow them to treat about 1% of the global population in the have-not countries. So essentially, antivirals won't be there, and it is crazy, and I use that word deliberately, it is crazy to focus attention on antiviral treatment, and even developing newer antiviral agents that won't be here for 10 or 15 years, when they will be so expensive and in such limited supply, and offer virtually nothing for the treatment of influenza for people in developing countries.
Well, and also you get to the same logistical problem that you have with vaccines. I mean, even if you've got it in your country enough for, you know, some capacity or a large percent of capacity, I believe, doesn't Switzerland have quite a stockpile, I think?
Pardon me?
I think, doesn't Switzerland have quite a stockpile percentage-wise for their population?
Oh, yeah, and, you know, other some small countries that are well off may have very, very large stockpiles. But, again, the resistance concern is very great.
Mm-hmm.
It means people are backing off from making decisions on buying antivirals. And even though there are arrangements that Roche has made to have this their product produced in developing countries, and recently a new agreement was, I think, updated with a very large pharmaceutical producer in India. And, of course, the prices will be less than what they are charging in developed countries. Still, the need is so great that producing these antivirals in short order will be very, very difficult. The only way that they could be effective in countries would be just to stockpile them, and as I said, people don't want to stockpile a drug that that the virus might become resistant to.
Correct. And the other issue that I've heard kind of on a micro level is if let's say your company X, and you've got your company's allocated a stockpile of your own Tamiflu for employees, which is what a lot of them have attempted to do or talk about doing. My contention is that let's say you are a husband and you go to this company X, and you have a wife and you have two small children, and the pandemic starts, and you now are handed your treatment course of Tamiflu so that you can keep going to your work and stay on the job.
Yeah.
What is a father with two small children going to do with his treatment course of Tamiflu?
He's going to give it to his family. I mean, if companies have any sense, they would stockpile them for the immediate family of their employees. But then within companies, I mean, do you treat everybody in the company from the sort of the janitor on up to the CEO? You've got equity issues within companies. And when you give a supply of an antiviral to a family, what do they do when their neighbors get ill? I mean, we are dealing with a problem of scarcity. And if the pandemic threat has done anything, it is then to provide a jobs program for ethics, because there are symposia after symposia that have appeared where ethicists talk about what you do to ration the supply of a scarcely available antiviral. Now, you know, whenever you have scarcity, you have these ethical problems. The only way to truly solve a problem of scarcity is to create abundance, because when you have abundance and everybody has access to what it is you're talking about, then the ethical issues of rationing and fair distribution disappear. Now, obviously, they never disappear completely, but you're well on your way to solving your problem when you have an abundant supply of something you regard as vital. We're nowhere near that with antiviral medications. We are nowhere near that with vaccines. And if we want to create abundance, we have to look at what we've already got.
Speaking of abundance or lack thereof, I had mentioned to you in an email that China apparently is curing H5N1 with a sera treatment. And, your response was that is something that also is more of a, what you call, a boutique treatment, but that won't be widely available. Did you want to explain your thoughts on that?
There are some very good studies, and in fact even historical studies that have gone back to the 1918 pandemic that indicate that if you give passively give antibodies that are specific to the virus, and you can get these antibodies by just taking the serum from somebody who's had the disease and has lived through it, recovered, and has now returned to health. If you take that person, take a large blood specimen and separate out the serum that has the protective antibodies, you can then administer these passive antibodies to somebody who's ill and allow them to live. I mean, we've known this for decades in the early 20th century, with the problems of transfusion being sorted out and the understanding of many bacterial infections. And